Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark.
True and Terrifying Stories, Volume 9, Story Number 1. My encounter happened in the winter of 1983. I was a senior in high school during this time. I was picking up a friend of mine who was visiting her boyfriend, who lived on Hurricane Creek Road in Putnam County. It was early evening and already completely dark outside. In 1983, Hurricane Creek Road was not as populated as it is now, and certain parts of the road were dark and narrow with many curves. After picking up my friend, we traveled back down Hurricane Creek Road towards the interstate. Not long after picking her up, we both experienced an odd event. As I was driving along the road, we both were rather quiet, making meaningless conversation, when all of a sudden, on the right side of the road, the side I was driving on, appeared two completely white, well-defined apparitions just standing there, facing us as we approached them. One was a woman wearing a country-type dress. The other was a small child standing beside her. The woman was holding the child's hand. I was driving approximately 45 miles per hour. My friend and I said nothing to one another during the quick encounter. We both turned our heads at the same time and looked over our right shoulder, and there was no one standing on the side of the road. We both turned and looked straight ahead again. I looked at my friend and said, "Did you see that?" My friend responded, "Yes." I said, "Did you see that they disappeared?" She responded, "Yes." We just kept driving to our destination and never said another thing about the incident ever again. I'm now 50 years old. This particular incident is one that has stuck in the back of my mind ever since 1983. I've never experienced anything like that since. I'm not one to hold on to memories or sentimental thoughts. I'm not a paranormal enthusiast. I am a have-to-see-it-to-believe-it type person. However, I'm 100% positive that my friend and I saw two ghostly apparitions on that dark road that winter evening in 1983. Story number 2. Shortly after my retirement as a police officer, I went to work for a public safety training agency. They had a satellite location at Glenville State College on the third floor of Lewis Bennett Hall. I was a training coordinator, and in addition to assisting with some criminal justice classes, I also brought in training that was available to law enforcement nationwide. The facilities included several classrooms, a firearm simulator, mini gym for defensive tactics, and student lodging. When I first started, the facility had been vacant for some time. I assisted the maintenance staff in freshening up and prepared to settle in. The first unusual thing that happened was the weekend before I opened up the site. My wife had come up with me to decorate my new office. We had brought our little mini pin, Zoe. While in the office, Zoe, who had been sleeping on the floor, jumped up and ran into the hallway barking. She then started growling and showing her teeth while backing up past the door. Finally, she lay there, eyes wide, and growling softly. I stepped into the hallway but could see nothing. I went to the stairwell door at the end of the hallway and made sure it was locked. I then checked all the classrooms and the mini gym. No one had gone past the office door, and the stairwell door was never heard to open or close. I returned Monday for my first day, lots of people coming to say hello, etc. Most took the elevator from the first floor. My office sat directly across from the elevator. Knowing that my wife was going to be late getting home from a conference, I decided to stay after hours to get some files in order. Several times after business hours, and when I assumed I was the only one in the building, the elevator would come to my floor, but no one was inside. Several of the staff on the other floors had casually mentioned that the building was supposedly haunted. Nothing specific, always with a wink and a laugh. By now, the whole elevator thing was getting old. The next time it happened, I went into the hallway and said, "I'm not ready to leave yet." At that moment, the file drawer that I had been working in shut on its own. Taking this as a sign that I was now ready to leave, I did. After that, little things would happen. Missing items that appeared later somewhere else, the elevator again, but nothing that I couldn't explain away. Then, I was talking to one of the maintenance guys. He said every morning when he came in and opened up the first floor offices, the people who had photos of dogs on their desks had them face down on the desk. We both thought this was a little strange, but there might be a reason. So one day I asked. The woman I talked to said, they didn't do it. It was always that way in the morning. She laughed a little and said, "Someone here doesn't like dogs." I immediately thought of Zoe. Sometime later, I was asked to do a community presentation on a drug issue that I was familiar with on a Saturday. Rather than drive all the way back to Parkersburg and have to return very early the next day, I chose to stay overnight at LBH and sleep in one of the instructor suites. Little nicer. I contacted the tech guy who would be setting up the president's auditorium and asked if he would be there to help me set up my laptop. He would be there early to get things going and would help when I showed up. I went over my PowerPoint for the presentation, watched a little TV, and went to bed. No big deal. Nothing happened. I got up the next morning, showered, dressed, and was having some coffee in the day room when I started choking. When I recovered, I walked back to the room to get my jacket and heard someone coughing, mimicking me a short time earlier. Thinking it was the tech guy, their office was on the second floor, I remember thinking that I would tell him I really had been choking. As I got my coat and laptop, I heard furniture being moved around on the second floor. I thought, good, he can't find something, and he's going to look stupid. I went to the auditorium and waited. Quite a while later, the tech guy came running in out of breath. He said he would go get his stuff and be right back. I said, "What did you forget?" He said, "Huh?" I said, "What were you looking for downstairs?" He just stared at me and asked what I was talking about. I said, "You know, when you made fun of me for choking, and then you were moving the chairs and cabinets around." He just looked at me again and said, "I just got here. My car wouldn't start, and I had to get my dad to bring me." Now I felt really stupid. Someone else had been making fun of me, and I blame this poor kid. Fast forward a couple of years. I'm now working at the agency's main office at the old West Virginia State Penitentiary. I know, out of the frying pan into the fire. Several of us were talking near Halloween. They said, "You must have had a good time at LBH on Halloween." I said, "I had never been there on that day." They all went on about it, being haunted. Curiosity got the best of me and I looked it up. I found an interview from the school paper with the vice president. She said that she had been working alone in LBH when she heard someone call her name, like mimicking me coughing, and then she heard the furniture in the hallway and other offices being thrown around. When she looked, nothing was moved. You can find her interview online at this college's website. Did I have a run-in with the LBH ghost? I don't know. But when I read her account, it gave me the chills. Next story. Being a surveyor in my past career, I had come across an area that I wanted to share with my wife, a forest fire tower and a microwave unit in one of the most remote areas in southern West Virginia. In surveying the area before, and probably just as true nowadays, was the fact there were no sounds of the wild. No birds tweeting, no squirrels squawking, or any of the noises one would find in West Virginia mountain wild areas. I stopped our car at the widened area near the junction of the gated Forest Fire Tower Road, just off 22 Mine Road, near Whitman-Logan County. We got out of the vehicle, and immediately my wife told me she felt as though we were being watched. The whole road had a history of being built with the bones of Chinese, Italians, and poor whites, their bones being used as the ballast or underlayment for the concrete highway used to service the mines in 22 Mine Hollow. They were shot or beaten and left to lay where they died and covered over with the sand, gravel, and concrete that made the road. As I consoled her and told her there was nothing to be afraid of, we continued to put on a backpack and begin our journey up the Forest Fire Tower Road. Shortly after passing the gate, I looked up and a tall, skinny figure appeared out of nowhere, just ahead of us, maybe 100 feet further up the road. I had been almost sure that there was no one there before, as I would have waited until they passed before we left a vehicle in the hands of a stranger. As he got closer, I noticed he had a brimmed hat on with the hood of a jacket pulled over the top of the hat. He held his head down as not to expose very much of what looked like an unshaven face. His clothing was that of 1920s, 1930s style, and was dirty and ragged. I spoke to him cordially, but got no response. Head down, continuing his walk down the road, as he passed, I could smell sweat and body odor. By this time, my wife was frantic to leave, for she got a really bad, evil feeling from just being there, much less a man walking past us, not even making a sound with his footsteps as he passed. Total silence. I knew he was real, for the wind of his passing against my face and the smell of his overworked body filled the air. He turned at the base of the Forest Fire Tower Road and headed towards US 119 Junction. My wife threatened to leave without me, so I walked back to her and tried to tell her there was nothing to fear. However, her with her feelings of unholiness abounding forced me to walk her back down to the vehicle. As we got to the car and pulled away down the main 22 Mine Road toward the junction of US 119, I noticed that we didn't pass the fellow we had seen before. So at the junction of the main highway, I turned and went back up the road where we had just come from, hoping to see the guy, and maybe he was resting alongside the road that I had missed before, the whole while trying to calm my wife, telling me that I was crazy for going back. We went to the end of the mine road, where it emptied into an area where rows of the mining camp houses once stood. I passed no one. The guy totally disappeared. Had it been such a circumstance that maybe over the edge of the road, in one of the hollows, there may have been somewhere for him to go? That could have explained it. But this area is totally out in the middle of nowhere. No homes within several miles, at least at that time. I took my wife home, and I have wondered to this day about the encounter we had with a possible ghost. One who had given his life trying to build a road to nowhere. To this day, when I have returned, one can feel the evil that surrounds the whole mountain and road that led to number 22 Mine, Island Creek Coal Company. No noise, no sounds of wildlife, only the eerie sound of one's own breath still bounds the length of this roadway built by hundreds back many years ago. But this is but one of many stories that make this place one of the most haunted places in southern West Virginia. Next story. Well, this happened about 2007. I started building a new house a few miles outside of Farmington. This house sits off the beaten path in the woods by itself. During the construction of the house, I witnessed some events that happened that at the time I didn't want to believe were happening. The first event happened one night when I was working to the wee hours of the night. I was putting laminate flooring down in the living room and finished up about 5 a.m. in the morning. I thought before I left, I would take a seat, grab a cold drink, and admire the job that I did. As I was sitting there, I noticed a box of corn pops sitting on a painter's scaffold in an adjacent room. Early, that box of cereal was sitting on a work table located beside the scaffold. I know this because it was close to the edge of the table, and I was concerned that it might fall off, so I moved it towards the center of the table. At that point, I got the feeling that I wasn't alone and probably had a ghost in my new house. Now, hang with me for a minute, and I want to give you a little background about myself and the experiences growing up with a ghost in an old Victorian-style house. This house was built around the turn of the 19th century in Mannington, and we moved into it around 1965. I believe my first experience with this ghost occurred in 1965, and I didn't realize it for several years. It was only after I got older and had other experiences with this ghost that I believe this ghost was my hero. My ghost encounter started back in 65 when I was only 5 years old. One day my mother had taken me to this house before we had moved into it. As I remembered, I was upstairs playing by myself in one of the bedrooms. This bedroom had two closets that flanked either side of a fireplace. Now, I have no idea why, but I was checking out the doorknob on the inside of one of those closets. It was the size of one of those cheap plastic water bottle caps, the real small ones. For some dumb reason, I got inside of that closet door and closed the door to see if I could get out. I'm sure that the reason the architect designed that door with a bottle cap doorknob on the inside was to challenge little fellows like me. Well, let me tell you, it got real dark real fast after I closed that door. I searched around for that knob, and when I found it, I put a death grip on it and turned with everything that I had. Tried a few times both directions, and to no avail. I was stuck. Who knows where my mom was at? I sure didn't. I started to panic a little bit, then all of a sudden, that door popped open. Years later, I had many experiences with a ghost, which I believed to be my guardian angel. I used to lay in bed, and sometimes I would hear the sound of someone walking up the stairs. Each one of those stairs had its own signature squeaky sound. I would hear each step until it hit the landing. Then I would hear the footsteps across the landing, then on up the last 5 stairs to the top. Then it would stop outside my bedroom door. Other experiences that I had were banging on the walls and ceiling around my bed, the sound of doors opening and closing. Plus, I even saw this ghost twice over the years. The first time that I saw it, I was downstairs in one of the living rooms. When you come into the home, you are in a foyer that is flanked by huge double French doors that open to a living room on the right and a family room on the left. Anyway, one Friday night, I chose to stay home and watch the new color TV instead of going out with a gang to the local watering hole. As I remembered it, I was watching TV and wasn't tired, but next thing I know, the sound of the big, heavy oak front door woke me up, and it's a dark house. I thought one of the gang had come home from the watering hole. I could see a silhouette of a body standing in the opening of the French door that was open. They were looking into the living room. I started calling out, "Is that you, Joe?" No answer. "Is that you, Brenda?" "How about you, John?" No answer. I turned my back and reached around to turn on the lamp so I could see who was there. After I turned the lamp on and turned back around, they were gone. No big deal. I figured whomever probably headed for the kitchen for some chow. I got up and headed for the kitchen, and when I stepped into that foyer, I experienced cold chills like I never had before. After I passed through the foyer into the family room, the chills were gone. I went from the dining room into the family room, turning on lights, and finally made it into the kitchen. Nobody was in the kitchen, so I worked my way back through the house. When I got in the foyer, those cold chills had come back. I checked the deadbolt on that big oak door, and it was locked. It was at that moment that I realized what had happened. I saw that ghost for the first time. I'll save the second sighting for another day. Let's get back to that box of corn pops sitting on the painter's scaffold. I didn't want to believe I had a ghost in my new house. Heck, it's a new house. No history there. No way this is happening. I thought I must have moved that box of cereal and just forgot about it. Finished my drink, and I left. Later on, I had a towel ring in one of the bathrooms that was sticking out 90 degrees from the wall instead of hanging straight down like it should be. Again, I'm not going to let my mind play tricks on me. I must have moved it to that position. It wasn't until one morning when my son was coming to visit that I realized that it wasn't my mind playing tricks on me. It was around 10:30 a.m., and me and my German Shepherd, Angel, were laying on the bed in the back bedroom watching TV. All of a sudden, it sounded like the back door opened and someone walked into the house. I figured it was my son. Angel figured it was an intruder and sprung up in attack mode. She raced through the house towards that door, carrying on like she was going to eat somebody. This went on for a little while. I thought it was my son messing with a dog. I got up and walked into that part of the house. Much to my surprise, I got those old familiar cold chills, and nobody was there, plus the deadbolt was still locked. Since then, I've had a lot of experiences with this ghost. I heard banging on the walls and ceiling. It scratched along the wall beside the bed one night. It messes with my electronics, turns the ceiling fan off and on, turns the fan lights off and on, turns the TV off and on, and changes the channel. It has touched me twice. The dog always alerts to it before I know it's there, and she always goes after it to try and attack it. I've gotten her to settle down and quit going after it. Myself, I'm not as good as the dog sensing it, but I don't do too bad. When I get a feeling like something isn't right or I get cold chills, I learn to trust these first impressions, and yes, I still live in the house with Angel and the ghost or ghosts. Next story. My family went and stayed at Cabuelingo State Forest in 2015 for the first time ever. First off, we were from Ohio and didn't know what to expect. When we arrived, we were staying in cabin number 7, but there was a plumbing problem. 6 hours later, we were moved to cabin 13 on the hill. The name of it was Summer's Cabin. I love that it was upon a hill and the scenery and the quietness. This cabin had a loft, so me and my sister, Faith, climbed up and slept. Sometime around 3 a.m., there was a loud banging on the door. I peeked down. My dad entered the living room. "Who's there?" my dad shouted. Silence. He shouted again and peeked out the window. He said nobody was there and to go back to sleep. Close to 6 a.m., we were awakened by crying. Once again, I peeked down from the loft. My dad opened the door this time, but nobody was there. So we all went back to sleep. 30 minutes later, there was a banging on the door again. My dad ran in and screamed, "Go away!" Later that day, the security guard came around to bring us wood. We told him about it, and he said it might be locals fooling around. Everything went well that day till we went to bed. Around 3 a.m., it started all over again. We were beyond frightened. We just huddled in my parents' bed till morning. We left there never to return. I do not know the story behind this, but I know it's true. Next story. This happened in December of 2007 in Bellington. I was 17 then. My girlfriend and I at the time were sitting in the living room listening to music. It was night, but I'm not too sure what time it was, probably around 8. I happened to look down the hall and I saw Boot coming out of the doorway to my mom and stepdad's room. In that split second, I thought my stepdad was home all along and that he was going to flip out on me for blasting music. That's when it happened. This man stepped out and made eye contact with me while he was walking across the hallway. It was something I thought I would never see in my lifetime, a ghost. Here's a breakdown of how it happened. I'll explain it the best way I can. As soon as it stepped out of my mom and stepdad's bedroom, it made eye contact with me and walked into the bedroom across from my mom's room. The room it walked into was my brother's old room. He moved out probably in the fall or winter of 2006, and after he left, we started using the room as a storage room. The ghost had on what appeared to be coveralls. He looked about 6 feet in height, but he could have been a bit taller. The figure wasn't solid either. He looked like a mist with some missing parts. For instance, his face was missing some parts along with the rest of his body, almost like he didn't have enough energy to appear completely, just enough for me to see him. It happened pretty quick, maybe a few seconds. I was in shock. It was the first time I had seen a ghost. I didn't want to be there in that house anymore. I put on my shoes, not saying a word, and started putting my coat on. My girlfriend was baffled by my actions. She didn't see the ghost. She was looking in the other direction. "What are you doing?" she asked, looking confused and worried. "We have to go," I told her. "Why?" she asked. "We just do," I said as she was putting on her coat and slipping her shoes on. The whole walk down the street, I was silent. I didn't want to talk about it. It felt like if I did, it would appear again. I was that scared. I finally told her what I saw when we got to the gas station. I went there because I wanted to be around people and lights. She believed me, which I was worried that she would think I was nuts, and a few minutes later we walked to her place where her mom gave me a rosary. I wasn't religious back then. I was raised Pentecostal and usually didn't dabble in anything like Catholicism, but at this time I was willing to try anything, so I accepted the rosary and kept it with me at all times until I woke up one morning to find it broken in my bed. I may have tugged at it in my sleep and accidentally broke it, but I'm not sure. Things got better after I moved out of there in August of 2008. Slowly, I started to feel sane again. Yes, I've nicknamed that house Hell House, and I still have nightmares to this day about that place. Next story. The summer of 1980, I was 16 and was visiting my family in West Virginia. My mom and my sister stayed with her parents for the summer while my dad was away at work. I grew up in Pennsylvania, but we visited West Virginia a lot. At the 4th of July approach, my granny, Tilly, was planning on taking the camper to East Lynn Lake. My papa, Bill, got the camper ready to go. The first day of July, we headed out on our camping trip. My sister, Anna, was 12 and had never been camping. I went camping with them when I was 10. We got the camper all set up, and me and my sister played in the creek. We grilled out and ate a ton of food. We played games, and at dark, we watched fireworks. That night, we slept on the sleeper sofa. I was awakened by a loud noise. I looked around the room. I heard a car door slam and a horn blow. I looked out the window to see a girl in a pale blue dress walking from an old blue car. I watched her as she disappeared into the woods. I saw her again every night. Finally, I talked to one of the security guards, and that guy told me about a story that a young girl on the 4th of July got in a car with a guy who picked her up, and he drove her to the secluded area of East Lynn and murdered her. Now her ghost is seen haunting on the 4th of July of every year. Next story. In the summer of 1965, when I was 15 years old, two friends and I saw what may have been a Bigfoot. We were spotlighting for white-tailed deer near Deer Run, a few miles from Franklin, West Virginia. Back then, it was legal to spotlight deer as long as you did not have a gun in the vehicle. I was riding in the front passenger seat, holding a powerful spotlight, when the light fell on what we thought at first was a very large black bear, standing on its hind legs. The creature was about 30 yards away in a field, about 10 feet below the road we were on. At first, it just stood there and looked at us, or rather, I should say, looked at the spotlight. I focused the light on its face, and we immediately knew it was not a bear. It had an almost human-like face. It stood about 7 feet tall and was covered with long, dark hair. After about 10 seconds, it turned away from us and walked across the field towards the woods. Just before the woods was a split-rail fence. The creature climbed the fence just like a human would. Once it got over the fence, it turned and looked back at us for about 5 seconds, and then again turned away and disappeared into the woods. A few days later, we were again spotlighting, and we saw it, or another one that looked like it. The creature was standing between an old church and a graveyard. We only saw it for about 5 seconds because it walked away very quickly. At the time of these sightings, we had never heard of Bigfoot and had no idea what it was. Looking back on the events years later, I am convinced that it must have been a Bigfoot. Next story. I guess a lot of people know about Wolf Creek near Fayetteville because it drops into the New River Gorge in a series of spectacular cascades. But I don't suppose many know that the creek heads up in the plateau near Oak Hill and that it was named because of wolves. Wolves haven't been seen in the state since the 1800s, except for one case I know about firsthand. The white wolf that haunts the Whitlock Farm on Wolf Creek Road. I suppose it's a ghost. A ghost wolf, not a white wolf, though, that's what they call it. Legend has it that the wolf prowls the fields around the old farm pond in the evening, but that its favorite haunt is in the bend in front of the old Whitlock farmhouse. The farmhouse isn't that spooky itself, though not everyone knows it because of its red and yellow brick. It's as much a part of the landscape as the big oaks that shade the yard around it. They say that late at night, people driving past the house catch a flicker of white in their headlights. That's the wolf. One night about 25 years ago, we were driving back from a party in town, and we saw the white wolf for ourselves. We were coming through the bend in front of the farmhouse when my boyfriend decided he wanted to pull over in front of the farm and get romantic. Everything seemed normal, though a little spooky, as there was no one living in the farmhouse then. I'd completely forgotten about the legend of the white wolf because I was more worried about seeing a ghost looking out the farmhouse window at me, which is another story I've heard about that place. At any rate, we were sitting there talking and the headlights were off, so you couldn't see much in the darkness, but still, I seemed to see a kind of white form moving around outside the car. I thought it was a trick of the eye at first, the way things look in the near dark, but then I kept seeing it move, I thought, through the tall grass near the car. I told my boyfriend to be quiet a minute. He didn't seem to notice anything and started laughing, but then, all of a sudden, I was standing there outside my car door and let out a howl so loud it was unbelievable. I could see his eyes looking at us, but I was paralyzed with fear and couldn't turn my head. John fumbled with the keys and got the car started and backed up right into Wolf Creek Road without stopping. Not that there was any traffic on the road at that hour anyway. We didn't stop until we were a mile down the road and then just pulled over and cried. We were so scared. I pass a farmhouse all the time now and haven't seen anything since. But then I'm not wanting to see anything again, so I don't look hard. Why the ghost wolf might haunt the farm, who can say? Maybe a hunter killed it, the last of its kind there in the little levels along the creek. Maybe it's guarding the house. Maybe people still see it from time to time. Every once in a while, I'll hear an old-timer from Garten or Gatewood talk about it. But for the most part, the legend seems to have slipped away. Next story. We bought a house which was also a log cabin that was built in 1766. It was located about 3 miles west of Hedgesville, beside Tillman Creek. The first night we spent there, I was sleeping on the floor when I felt something pushing up against me. It was a large dog laying beside me, and he or she had stretched out, thus touching me and waking me up. We didn't own a dog at that time. I was so tired and exhausted from moving that I said, the heck with it, I'm going back to sleep. That same night, I woke up again. This time I saw a tall black figure standing in the doorway. I figured it was my husband. He had fallen asleep on the couch. I asked him several times what he wanted, but didn't get an answer. There again, I said, the heck with it, and went back to sleep. The next morning he said it wasn't him and that he had not gotten up at all that night. Through the month, we would hear loud footsteps pounding up the stairs, but no one was there. Doors would slam shut. Another time a young man stood beside me. He was watching me clean the cobwebs. I saw him clear as can be, but he was a ghost. The space around us was bone cold and it scared me, so I went outside to warm up and get away from him. It was 90 degrees out that day. Other things like that happened to me, but I won't get into that. The house, the cabin, whatever you want to call it, burned down. The good thing, though, is we rebuilt, and there's been no more ghosts. Next story. When I was about 16 years old, I had a good friend of mine named Mitch. We both lived in a town of Sissonville, which is about 17 miles from Charleston, along the Pocatalico River. There were several of us from Sissonville that hung around together and were close friends, but the story I want to tell now is something that happened to Mitch and me. I have told this story to some people that I have known in my adult life, but I am very selective in who I tell it to, mostly because it's so unbelievable. And it is usually met by the normal reply, "What were you drinking?" or "What kind of drugs were you on?" or "You're full of it," or "Crazy." So it's rare that I ever speak of it. I don't think about it all the time, but there are times when the memory comes back to me and it makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck and has brought tears to my eyes on some occasions when I've told it because of the emotions of how terrifying that night was, which I relive every time I talk about it. And it even caused me, a grown man, to walk out of the woods before dark with a loaded gun in my hand while hunting when I have let the memory of that night flood back and spook me. I've come to the conclusion that not all things in life can be explained, and what happened on the night I am referring to will, I believe, forever remain a mystery to me. I don't see Mitch very often anymore, not because we have parted friends, but because our life paths and careers sent us in different directions and have taken most of our spare time. Mitch and I both married later on in life, and I moved to my current location, which is the city of St. Mary's, and Mitch moved to Goldtown. We have occasionally seen each other through the years, and usually we always seem to end up talking about the thing that happened to us that night. It amazes me at the details we both have retained, as if it somehow was branded into our memories. The only difference we have when telling our story is to what conclusion we have come to as to what exactly happened and why. I have my theories and Mitch his, but we both still agree it is a great mystery, and it terrified us both. I'm 51 years old now, and I wanted to record this for my children and my grandchildren to come, before, God forbid, I would die or my mind would fade away. I first wish to offer something about my character. I pride myself on the fact that if I tell you something, you can take it to the bank as being a fact. Secondly, I have not a thing to gain by fabricating a story such as this. I want no money or notoriety, and I fear that it may make some people doubt anything further that I would state as fact. The reason for me to do this in written form is not in publication, but for the benefit of my family, that it may be passed on to other generations. If preserved in some form and passed down, maybe my great-grandchildren will have the same reply as many, but at least they will have the true version of what happened that was written by my hand, and not just a passed down as a ghost story. I will tell my story, and I am then going to send a copy of it to Mitch and ask him to write about his account or verify that this did truly happen. And then I'm going to place all the paperwork in my family history folder and let the matter be placed to rest. Anyway, here is my story. I don't remember the exact month this happened. I know it was summertime and it was a hot day. Mitch and I were together on this occasion because we both dated a couple of young ladies that lived in the vicinity of the town of Frame. I dated a girl by the name of Brenda, and Mitch was dating a young lady named Bonita. Brenda lived with her parents just across the street from Bonita in a small brick home, and Bonita's parents had a white wooden house with a large front porch. Mitch had decided he was going to his lady's house that evening, and I believed I asked him if I could ride along with him to see mine. Mitch owned his own car at that time. It was a Pontiac Le Mans convertible, goldish tan in color with a black ragtop. I didn't own a vehicle and always hitched rides with friends, thumbed or walked to where I needed to go. I would like to say at this time that I have walked many a country road and have been walking isolated country roads from the time I was 10 or 11. So I was no stranger to lonely, spooky country roads, and I didn't scare easily. When I was only 9 or 10, I had a friend named Randy that lived on Second Creek Road, and I would walk all the way from my mom's to Randy's house through pasture fields, and then a long stretch through a pine forest, about a 5-mile hike, and there were several times I got my hide tanned for not being back home before it got dark. I always liked the woods, and there was nothing in them to fear, though a deer sidled me through the woods one night and it spooked me. I was never terrified. Anyway, those are other stories. I just wanted to make a point that I'm used to the woods and the creatures in it, and certainly was no coward that feared the boogeyman. Frame was a very small community, about 20 miles from Sissonville. There were two ways you could get there from Sissonville. You could get on I-77 and go to Charleston, then go up I-79 to Frametown Road exit, and where the girls lived was probably 5 or 6 miles from the exit. In all, it was about a 30 or 35 mile trip one way. But most people from Sissonville would just travel through Poca River Road, out through what was called Leatherwood, and it would bring you over to Frame Road. It was an old single-lane blacktop road, lots of potholes and twists and turns. You couldn't drive 65 miles an hour, but it was shorter than the alternative by probably 12 to 15 miles. So Mitch and I always traveled Old Pokey Road, as we called it. I don't recall the time of day that we got there. We all met at the Miller's house, and then Brenda and I went over to hers. I recall I spent a good deal of time spooning with Brenda, and as it was nearing dusk, there came a heck of a thunderstorm. Mitch called over to Brenda's and said we were going to have to get home before it got really bad. So Brenda and I ran over through the pouring rain and sat down on the porch with everyone else and got into a conversation. Now, I will be up front and say I didn't in particular care much for Mitch's girl, and I don't believe there was any love lost on her part over it. My opinion was she was kind of uppity, like thinking she was a little smarter and better than everyone else. Somehow the conversation got shifted to religion. Bonita sure spoke her opinion of how we were all living wrong, and she knew the only path to salvation, which maybe she did, but it ticked me off the way she put it, and I told her I was an atheist just to make her mad, and it did. I remember her saying something to the effect of, "I better watch what I say," and seeing as I had gotten under her skin, I laid it on pretty hot and heavy as to how there was no God. Remember, I'm 16 years old and hot-headed, and I sure wasn't going to be outdone by some Bible-thumping girl that I didn't care much for. After our little disagreement, the conversation ended and the weather took a turn for the worse. The wind started picking up and lightning was hitting close and the rain got harder. Mitch said we needed to leave, which I'm sure Bonita didn't mind seeing me go at all. So I ran Brenda back across the street, gave her a goodnight kiss and headed back towards the Millers. I was on a dead run when I felt the hair stand up all over me, and I saw the flash and felt the concussion, then the explosion. It literally almost knocked me down, and to this day, that is the closest I've ever come to being hit by lightning. I managed to keep my footing and made it back to Bonita's porch, all wide-eyed and out of breath. The only thing I could think to say was, "Did you see that?" And they had. Bonita reminded me at that time as to how I should watch what I say about God, and if she would have given a good sermon, at that point, she might have gotten a convert. But the lightning came crashing again, and Mitch said we needed to hit the road, and I agreed. He got his kiss in, and I was already soaked. But by the time we walked a few feet to his car and got in, he was just as drenched as me. I guess it was probably about 9:30 or so, maybe a little less at that time. It seemed that just in a few moments' time, it had gone from sunset to total black, and it was pitch dark as we pulled out of her driveway and onto Frame Road. It was one of those storms where the rain was pouring and the wind was blowing it straight into us, and you could literally see it coming down in sheets. Mitch had the wipers going full blast, but they couldn't even phase the amount of water that came onto the windshield. The wipers probably would have done as much good being on the inside as the outside. We could only see a few feet ahead of the front of the car. You couldn't even see the road. It was a guessing game as to if we were in the middle of the road or about to run off either edge. We were only driving about 10 or 15 miles an hour, and each lightning flash only blinded us. It didn't illuminate the road, and there was plenty of it and hitting all around. Through the lightning flashes, you could get glimpses of the surroundings, and we were navigating from memory. There's a turn coming up after the next house, or at the bottom of this little hill is a left turn. Frame Road was not very populated then, but there were a few houses, and you could see porch lights burning, or lights shining faintly through the sheets of rain. We finally came to a long, straight stretch we both knew, but the rain just got harder. This stretch was one we were familiar with, but the rain was coming down so hard the only way to tell if you were on the road, was to wait till you ran off of it so you could feel it. When we entered the stretch, we were completely blind, and we knew that at the end of it was a sharp right turn we would have to somehow navigate. Luckily, at the end of the straight stretch marking our right-hand turn was a street light at someone's driveway, and we knew if we just drove towards the street light, we would make it. It was kind of like a lighthouse beacon to a fog-bound ship. The lightning was starting to let up at this point, but the rain sure hadn't. We were about halfway down the stretch when, for no reason, the light just went out, and we both said, "Oh, crap," at the same time. No lightning had flashed, and there was still lights on in houses, but we lost our beacon. It was as if someone knew we needed it on and turned it off for spite. I mention this for a reason, as you will find out deeper into the story. We slowed down a little more, and I honestly could have outwalked the pace we were driving at. It seemed like it took us forever to drive the 5 miles or so where we turned off Frame Road and onto Poca River Road. When we started up Poca River, the rain eased up a little bit and Mitch sped up, and it was at this time we noticed the car starting to shake. We commented on it to each other and were listening for those familiar sounds of rubber flapping or a bearing starting to squeal, but heard nothing. We were still only going maybe 25 miles an hour or so, and the shaking was getting worse. About a mile or so into this, there was a church parking lot on the left, and we pulled into it and got out into the rain to see if we had a wheel that was flat or about to fall off. We both walked around the car and checked the tires, and we even pulled on them to see if we could get them to shake, but could find nothing wrong. We got back in, and both of us had gotten drenched again. We discussed what could be going on and what we needed to look, listen, and feel for to diagnose our problem. The rain was coming in spurts now. It would pour for a minute, then let up to drizzle, then pour again. But the lightning hadn't stopped. We started the car back up and pulled onto the road, and as soon as we got to about 25 miles an hour, the shaking started again. The section of road we were on now was a little straight stretch, maybe a half mile in length, and there were probably about 6 houses along the stretch to the right, with the last house being at the bottom of a little rise on the right. As we went past it, there were no lights on in the house, but they had an outside street lamp beside their home, just off the side of the front porch. I really didn't notice all that as we drove by, but knew about and remembered it later. We got about 150 yards past the house and almost to the top of the rise, and by this time the car felt like it was going to fall apart. There was a wide gravel spot on the shoulder to the left, and Mitch pulled off into it and said we had to find out what was going on with his car. We got out, and this time we both found it immediately. We had a flat on the front. Now both of us were amazed as to how we could have missed this the first time we stopped. We both had walked around and checked for just that very thing on the first stop, but somehow we both had missed it. Mitch says something to the effect of, "Oh no," and I said, "Well, this isn't a problem. We just change it and get on our way." That's when he told me he didn't have a jack, and worse yet, he didn't have a spare. So this was a big problem. We stood there a few minutes and discussed our options, and Mitch said maybe we could walk down the hill to the house with a streetlight and use their phone to call his brother, Bud. There were no cell phones in those days. It was still raining somewhat, not a downpour like before, but it was steady. Now, this was the 1970s. Fine people like Charlie Manson had been running around with long hair and murdering people in the middle of the night. And since Mitch and I were like all other youth of the nation, we had long hair as well, and we sure didn't have on tuxedos, just old flannel shirts and worn-out blue jeans, soaking wet and looking like a couple of bums, which was how we all wanted to look like back then. I remember we walked up to the sidewalk and the steps onto the front porch of that house. It had to be going on 10 p.m. by this time, and Mitch about fell going up the steps, because his glasses had fogged up completely and he commented he couldn't see a thing. He knocked on the front door and we noticed all the lights were out. We commented about hating to get someone out of bed, but this was a true emergency. No one came the first knocking, so Mitch knocked again, and this time we heard footsteps coming and the curtain draws back a little and someone asked, "Who is it?" Mitch answered and said, "Our car has a flat and we need to come in and use your phone," which in hindsight was probably not the best way to greet someone in the middle of the night and have them let you into their house. The man behind the door replied, "Just a minute," and the curtain closed. We heard him walk back through the house and Mitch and I were discussing how to talk to his brother Bud into bringing us a Jack and a spare. I think I said something to the effect that Bud's going to be mad when the front door of the house jerked open, and there stood an older man with a shotgun pointed at us and said, "No, you can't use the phone, and get off of his porch." I jumped back about 2 feet and was going down the steps in a hurry when I heard Mitch say, "Why can't we use your phone?" I just remember the guy cursing something and threatening to shoot us. I looked back at that point and Mitch was standing right where he had been, and that's when I remembered he couldn't see out of his glasses. I shouted back up for him to come on, and he said something like, "Well, I just want to know why he won't let us use his phone. This old man has the gun leveled at Mitch's head." And I said, "Mitch, he has a shotgun pointed right at you." That sunk in real quick, and Mitch came down off the porch, and we heard the guy mutter something and slam the door. We walked back out the sidewalk to the road and then walked 150 yards or so back to the car. Now it was time to come up with a plan B, which we hadn't figured on before. We discussed maybe going back to some of the other houses we had passed, but decided that after the warm reception we received on the first, that maybe the next might just shoot first and ask questions later. So that was out. We were standing outside the car at this point and trying to come up with a plan. Mitch was supposed to be home by 11, and we were already near or past that. Neither of us had a watch. We decided we would try to hitch a ride, as walking the 15 to 18 miles the rest of the way to Sissonville was not an option. As we stood there at the side of the road, we began to take note of our surroundings. To the left of the road, which was the side we had pulled off on, there was a barbed wire fence a few feet over the hill, and then, as near as we could tell, a little bottom land between us and the river. To the right of the road was another barbed wire fence, and the hillside was fairly steep and grown up in briars and weeds for a couple of 100 feet, then turned into woods. We could see the street light and the guy with the gun's house down at the bottom of the hill. We walked onto the top of the rise, which was only about 50 feet or so, and there was nothing else, as far as we could see, going down the other side of the hill but darkness. We walked back to the car and leaned against the hood. I just stood there and talked and waited for a car to come by. I know at least an hour passed before the only car we saw came through, and he sure wasn't slowing down to pick up a couple of stranded hippies. We began to discuss our options again, and about this time is when things got really weird. It began with hearing what sounded like someone hammering nails to the right of the road up on the ridge. It sounded to be a good distance off. More hammering noise joined the first, and it sounded as though several people were hammering nails, and then it sounded like someone started running a circular saw. This went on for a full 2 or 3 minutes, and Mitch and I both commented on who in the world would be building a house or a barn at this hour of the night, and we could see no lights at all in the direction the noise was coming from, and it was in the middle of the woods. This was very strange indeed. And then just as suddenly as it had started, and at the pitch of what seemed to be a whole lot of activity, it suddenly stopped. Not slowly as it started, it just stopped, and you could hear crickets chirping. We had our attention focused on that side of the hill, and would look back at each other, then stare until our eyes hurt trying to see something. I remember hearing brush cracking and weeds rustling or something coming down off the hill, and then quiet again. We must have stood there another 5 minutes after that, and were trying to figure out what it was that we had heard. We were still focused on the right-hand side of the road. It was at this time that something gave out across between a scream and a deep guttural groan in the bottom to our left between the river and us. Mitch looked at me and said, "Was that a bear?" And I remember saying I had never heard a bear sound like that. Now, I'm not going to lie, we were both getting a little spooked at this point, and we now had our attention focused back down the hill towards the guy with the gun's house to the bottom land on the left of the road. We were both very focused at this point, as neither of us had ever heard a noise like this, and haven't to this day since that night. We stood there for what seemed like 20 minutes, but honestly, I don't know how long it was, and we were trying to figure out what we heard. Then the street light went out at the house. The guy with the gun had turned on an inside light and had never turned it back off, and we could see through that burning that his candles that it wasn't a power failure. We both stood there for a few seconds longer, and then we heard whatever it was scream out again. Whatever it was screaming sounded mad and big. We both wasted no time getting in the car, Mitch in the driver's side and me in the passenger seat. Now, we were scared. I won't cut any bones about it. I know I was shaking, and I could hear shaking in Mitch's voice. We started trying to convince each other that whatever it was that we just heard, there had to be an explanation. We started once again in discussing new options, as here we were with some wild beast somewhere in our vicinity, and it sounded mad. And here we sat in a ragtop convertible with a flat tire that wasn't going anywhere. We were talking about what to do when Mitch said, "Listen." The best way I know how to describe what we heard next was it sounded like something walking in a huge set of rubber gumboots full of water. Kind of sucking, squishing, heavy sound, and it was coming up the road right behind the car. We both sat there, totally still, listening to that thing walking up behind us, and then it let out another scream, or howl, whatever sound you would call it, and it was right at the back of the car, and it was huge. I say it was huge because the sound was not coming from a low level near the road, but sounded instead like it was above the top of the car from the rear. I have thought many a time since that day, and I've had other people ask me, why didn't you look back to see what it was? Quite simply, I couldn't, and neither could Mitch. It was so terrifying, I didn't want to see what it was. I just wanted to get away. Have you ever seen kids scare each other and watch the one that got scared? He will run 4 or 5 feet before turning around to see what scared him. It is basic instinct. I think when you are truly terrified, this is how you react to it. What I did do was to reach over and start the car. Mitch was in an attempt to do this, but I beat him to it. He floored the gas and yanked it into gear. Now, this was a fairly powerful car, as Mitch had hopped up the motor somewhat, and those big old tires on the rear started chucking gravel. If you have ever had a flat on a front tire and pulled into gravel and stopped, that flat tire is the equivalent of putting a chalk block in front of your tires and trying to take off. My thought in those first few split seconds is that we were stuck and our butts are eaten. Then the car slowly started easing forward, and whatever was behind us was getting the rock stoning of its life. The car kind of lurched forward a couple of times, and we finally got up enough momentum to get the flat tire up onto the blacktop, and when the rear tire came into the blacktop, we had gravel flying and tire squealing. I don't know if you have ever tried to drive a car with a flat front tire, but what we immediately found out was that it's possible, but you aren't going to go very fast. Both of us were almost hysterical, and we kept shouting, "What was that?" But neither of us had an answer, and I'm convinced we were both fairly happy we hadn't found out. The car was kind of hopping down the road, and we couldn't do more than 20 or 25 miles an hour, but at least that was putting distance between us and whatever we had encountered. We had driven about half a mile or 3/4 of a mile when we came around a turn, and there was a house to the left. No lights on in the house, but they had a street light in the drive, so we pulled in under the light in the drive. Both of us jumped out of the car, ran up to the door, and were knocking frantically and shouting at the top of our voices for someone to help us. After a good minute or two of knocking, we were coming to the conclusion that nobody was home, so we stopped knocking and shouting and just stood there for a minute. We were in a place where it was bright and we could see in all directions, and it was obvious that nothing was going to grab us, so we started to calm down. We began talking about what had happened and were questioning whether it was real or not. We walked back to the car and got in, and we actually began to convince ourselves that we had just panicked. There had to be a reasonable explanation as to what had occurred. Just about then, the street light went out. It didn't flicker or dim, it just went off, and it was now pitch black. This got both our attention real quick, and we sat silent for a few moments. Then Mitch said, "Listen." Faintly you could hear that squishing, sucking sound coming up the road. I remember thinking, this is impossible. But it was unmistakable and getting louder. This thing, whatever it was following us. It didn't get right behind us as previously and scream, but it was close when it did scream. I didn't have to start the car as before. Mitch beat me to it this time, and he yanked the car into gear, and we pulled back onto the road, squealing rubber again. Now, we were both scared at this point, but not in a panic as the first encounter, and we started hopping down the road again on our flat tire. We talked going down the road, and we were still trying to come up with an explanation as to what was happening. But there was no sane explanation for it. Mitch was driving the car as fast as he could and still be able to control it. It was difficult, and I know he hated abusing his vehicle in this manner, but there was no other choice. We didn't have to say it between us, but we both knew walking was not even an option to consider. That old ragtop convertible sure wouldn't have kept something from tearing through it and grabbing us out, but at this time it was moving faster than we could run, and it was putting distance between us and whatever it was behind us. And it was our fort for the moment, and I was sure thankful for it. We drove this time for what seemed about 4 or 5 miles, and we had passed a few homes, but none showed any signs of activity. All were dark. The tire was starting to come apart at this time, and you could hear the rim cutting the blacktop. We finally came to a place where another road intersected with Poca River Road on the left. The name of it was Whiteman's Fork. There was a street light there, and almost directly across from this intersection, across the road on the right, was a house with lights on inside, and you could see the flicker of a TV playing. Mitch kind of just slid his car into the intersection, and we both jumped out and ran towards the house. I remember it sat down a steep embankment from the road, and as soon as we came to the top of the embankment, we could hear and see they had a rather large dog on the front porch. Now, most of the time, both Mitch and I had respect for large, snarling dogs, but on this night it seemed to be the least of our concerns. The dog didn't bite us when we came up to the front door, but he sure wasn't happy to see us. We knocked on the door, and when it opened, I don't think we even waited to be invited in. We just kind of stepped inside. I remember an older man and woman sitting in a chair watching TV, and it was a younger boy that had let us in. We asked to use the phone and briefly explained our situation. I believe you could see in our faces that we had been through an ordeal, and they had mercy on us. They directed Mitch to the phone, and as he called his house, I tried as calmly as I could to explain what had happened. These poor people must have thought us to be completely insane, as I explained to them what had occurred, and you could see by the looks on their faces they were filled with doubt and suspicion. Mitch got in touch with his parents and explained where we were, and they got in touch with Bud on the CB radio, as he was already out looking for us. Mitch's parents told him to sit tight on the car, and Bud would bring us a spare and a jack. When Mitch got off the phone, we tried to rationally explain to this family what had happened, and we briefly discussed it with them, and then thanked them for letting us use their phone. Mitch told them that his brother was going to bring us a spare, and that we would wait in the car for him to come. We both had calmed down at this point, as help was on its way, and we realized how insane we must have appeared to these people with the story we told them and the wide-eyed look we had when we entered their home. We thanked them very gratefully and walked back out into the night. The dog wasn't barking at us now, as I guess he figured if his masters had let us in, then we must be all right. We walked up to the embankment and back across the road to our car, sitting under the streetlight. We looked over the tire and it was in bad shape, and we commented that we were glad it had held up as good as it had for the abuse we had put it through. We both had settled down. We started making jokes about what had happened and how we must both be insane and kind of embarrassed, as well and how we had panicked as we had. We both talked about if we had seen what it was, and we both agreed that we hadn't wanted to. We were just glad to be able to get away from it. We sat in the car and talked for what must have been 5 minutes or so, and we were both calm at this point, still mystified and maybe a little jumpy, but we felt safe. Just then, the dog at the house we were at started barking. It wasn't just a casual bark, it was an "if you come near me, I will bite you" bark. Mitch and I both looked behind us down the road we had just traveled on and tried to see into the dark, but you couldn't see anything past the glow of the street lamp we were under. We were back on alert again. The dog was mad at something, and we were trying to see what it was that had him so upset. Just then, the street light went out, just like all the other times before. No flickering or dimming, just turned off. It was pitch black again, and we could see the house we had just left, and the lights were still on inside. You could still see the TV flickering. I think I must have said something like, "You've got to be kidding me." And Mitch said, "Be still." That's when we heard it coming again. That same old sucking, squishing noise we were now starting to become familiar with. We didn't sit there and wait for it to get closer this time. We started the car and started driving. We didn't give it a chance to let out another of those terrible screams. We decided we would drive until we met Bud on the road, and then we could ride with him the rest of the way home. I don't know how many miles we drove that time. There was a little conversation between us, just silent prayers that our ride would hold together till we met Bud. I remember we passed a vehicle, and as it was going past, we both recognized it as Bud's El Camino. We could see him hit the brakes, and Mitch just drove his car into the ditch on the right and pulled it into the embankment on the other side of the ditch. It was kind of a controlled wreck. We saw Bud turning around, and when he was headed back in our direction, we jumped out as he pulled beside us. We both just jumped into his vehicle, and he kind of looked at us funny and said, "Your tire and jack are in the back. Aren't you going to fix it?" I think we both answered in unison, "No, just get us out of here." Bud made a lame attempt at telling us it would only take a few minutes to fix it and that Mitch shouldn't leave his car abandoned beside the road. Mitch said he didn't care about his car. We just wanted to get out of here and we would come back when it was daylight and get it then. I think Bud could tell how scared we were, so he didn't try real hard to convince us otherwise. He made one more attempt at telling us we shouldn't leave the car sitting, and I think we told him if he wanted to fix it, we would sit in the car with it running and watch. That must have convinced him that nothing was going to happen, and we drove off, leaving the old Le Mans sitting in the ditch. We told our story to Bud going down the road, and he, like many others since then, that we've told the story to, tried to convince us there had to be a reasonable explanation for what had occurred. And we had just let our imagination run wild, but we knew different. I lived up a little hollow called Sisson Lane, and Bud dropped me off at the mouth of it. I remember I ran as hard as I could all the way to Mom's and was very relieved when I got inside and closed the door. It took a long time to settle down and go to sleep that night, but sleep finally did come. The next day, me, Mitch, and Mike Huffman, or Ralph Miller, drove out to Poca River to change the tire and bring it home. I remember us telling Mike or Ralph about what happened, and Mitch and I fully expected when we would get to the car, the top would be all shredded and the car practically destroyed when whatever it was that pursued us found it abandoned and its prey gone. When we got to it, it was just as we had left it, no huge claw marks through the cloth top or down the sides. The hood and windshield were not all smashed in, not a thing to confirm we had escaped the creature that pursued us the night before that was so intent on catching us and doing us harm. All we were left with was a story and a memory that I will never forget. Well, that is my version of the story as I remember it. I will be glad to get Mitch's version and compare just to see if he remembers things differently, or if there are still details that I have forgotten over the years and he can remind me. We talked about this for years, and I know both of us have questioned our sanity over the event of that night. We discuss explanations for it, such as aliens, Bigfoot, or just a practical joke someone played on two young men that night. But we always came to the same conclusion. It didn't make any sense. What could shut off streetlights, scream as that thing did, and make the footsteps sound it had? I don't know, but I will never forget. It is just one of those things that you had to be there to believe. I'm convinced it is just a mystery that will take to my grave. Next story. I was walking with friends at night along the tracks that lead west out of Oak Hill toward Dothan. This gap is where the railroad crosses between the valleys of Loup and Paint Creek. On the Oak Hill side of the gap, a lot of people live, but on the far side, there's no one for miles. We didn't mean to be out that long, but there we were. There was enough light to be able to see the rocks along the tracks, so it was scary, but we could still make our way back to our house near Collins School. When we got to where the Silver Gap is, we saw a gray form about the height of a person in the woods overlooking the track. It was really hard to make out, but it was there. It could have been a wisp of smoke or fog, but it stayed in the same place for a few minutes while we stood there and freaked out. Finally, we got our courage up and began to move past it. Once we got past it, suddenly it began to move and came down the bank to the tracks. We ran on ahead a little way and looked back. It was still there standing on the track. It felt like it was watching us. Then it slowly started moving away from us along the track until it disappeared into the dark. A second later, we heard what sounded like a man cry in horror. At that point, we ran all the way back to where we could see the lights over near Round Hill Road. I'll never forget how it looked or how scared we were. I've never heard of anything about Silver Gap or why it's named that, or if someone was killed near there. But I know what we saw and heard.